Okay, we are now back on the record. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, we are. A couple preliminary things.
Okay.
Commissioners did ask for kind of a overview of our witnesses. We're planning on calling three witnesses in this order. Bruce Beachy to address the alluvial valley floor issue, Dean Mose to address soil issues, and Jim Deitch to address coal mining and permitting program in general and the requirements and standards. Jim also will have the two spreadsheets that people have alluded to a time or two in the last 3 days of hearing. I do want to mention that we don't have an Exhibit 1 and 2 because they were going to be the same exhibit that I think is Coyote 10. Exhibits 3, 4, and 6 I passed out during the break. They are the resumes of Bruce Beachy, Dean Mose, and Jim Deitch. They were stipulated to by the parties via email, and so I'd like to get those admitted. The parties also at my responded to my request that they stipulate to the expertise, expert witnesses for those three gentlemen, for Bruce Beachy in hydrology and geology and hydrologic impact assessments of mining and AVF status determinations. For Dean Mose, soil science, soil mapping, classification, interpretation, and management, and soil reclamation. And for Jim, coal mining and reclamation program implementation and administration. So with those preliminary matters, I will submit it to you by stipulation of the parties. I will call Bruce Beachy.
Okay. Let's go ahead and just admit PSC exhibits 3, 4, and 6 up front right now. As Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco indicated, the parties have stipulated to each of the witnesses' expertise in the particular areas, and as to the admission of these exhibits, they're admitted. And Mr. Beachy, before you testify, I'm required to give you the oath as well. And again, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota, Class C felony, punishable by maximum fine, $10,000. Maximum 5 years imprisonment or both, and being advised of the penalty for perjury. Do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Beachy, would you state your name, your address, and spell your last name for the record, please?
Bruce Beachy. Excuse me, by the way, I'm losing my voice. I've been sick for about a week, but I'm going to do the best I can, folks. Bruce Beachy, spelled B-E-E-C-H-I-E. Address is 1401 16th Street Southeast in Mandan, 58554. Work for the Public Service Commission.
Thank you. Your resume has been admitted. Would you please summarize your qualifications and experience as it relates to the issues in this hearing?
I've been worked as a geologist and hydrologist for the Reclamation Division for the past 8 years. And prior to that, 20 or 22 years prior to that, worked as a geologist and project manager for their abandoned mine lands program, also of the Public Service Commission, and worked on all aspects of geology and hydrology involving the abandoned mine lands projects. For me in particular, working with reclamation of abandoned underground coal mines, essentially by pressure grout injection projects across North Dakota.
And have you also worked on surface mining permits regarding the hydrology and the determination of alluvial valley floor?
I do. That's what I've been doing currently, and which includes all aspects of geology and hydrology with mining permits, including post-mining hydrologic assessments, permit applications, bond release applications, and I respond to water supply complaints, occasional complaints from landowners, and basically anything geology and hydrology related for the Reclamation Division.
And did you work on the alluvial valley floor filings that preceded the permit filing for the case at issue?
I did.
Can you tell me in your own words what that involved and how, what process you used and what your conclusions were?
and I know this has been mentioned a few times, but alluvial valley floor determination is a pre-mine application before mining company can submit a permit application. They need to supply us with a study regarding potential alluvial valley floor status. If there's stream channels either within or adjacent to the proposed permit area. And so these folks, sometimes it's the mine personnel themselves, other times it's a consultant. There's a significant amount of data that they need to generate or attain. This data mostly deals with soils and vegetation, some geology, hydrology, and geomorphic information. So basically, they provide a report to us. We review this report, and usually the next course of business is for us to go out and do a field investigation. And when we go out and do these field investigations, which we did for the Voigt property, this would have been DWC revision 22 to KRSB 8603, which would be the AVF area in question for this particular. Dr. Bickel spoke about, actually there's two AVF reports and determinations within this permit area, but I think the biggest one with the complainants that they're concerned about is the DWC revision 22 report and investigation. So for this particular, we received the report, and then there was four of us from the PSC that went out and did an investigation. We typically do this. Amongst those was myself, Dean Mose, Guy Welsh from the PSC, and also Bill Gunnarsson. Dean and Bill Gunnarsson are both soil scientists. Guy Welsh is a vegetation expert and geology and hydrology on my part. So when we go out and do these investigations, we do everything we can to cover all of the components of a potential AVF, and based on that, in our review of the data provided by either the coal mining company or the consultant, we make a determination on AVF status.
And what was your determination in this case?
Our determination in this case is that there was not AVF.
That's consistent with the testimony you heard today from Dr. Bickel, is it not?
Yes, it is.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Broughton?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Beachy, with respect to Section 21, which has been the subject of a lot of conversation and is the section that contains Mr. Voigt's alfalfa fields, what study was conducted to determine whether or not that area contained AVF?
Did you say Section 21 or 31?
I meant 31.
I believe it's 31. We concentrated on the big cropland tract that's located in the south half of Section 19 and the north half of Section 30. There's a large 100-acre tract, and then there's a couple of smaller tracts on the north side or northeast side of the creek. And what we did was, I think the first thing we did is dug some holes, at least half a dozen holes to about a foot and a half depth. And the reason that we did that was to try and determine, number one, what the soils are of the area. And there's definite soil types associated with floodplain and terrace systems. And what we figured out there is that, according to our soil scientists, is that straw loam and shambo loam were the two soil series represented. They are not sub-irrigated soils. Another thing we are looking for in the soils investigation part of it was a condition called redoxomorphic conditions, also known as modeling. Basically, iron oxide content in the soil or the soil horizon from intermittent flooding and drying out, which is also a condition associated, which would be a condition associated with sub-irrigation.
And right now you're talking about the field study you did, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and that was a part of a larger study, right? Let me ask a different question. That field study was associated with the Dakota Westmoreland Company Revision 22 AVF report?
Yep, and we did. We also did a field investigation for the Coyote Creek AVF report and areas as well too. Two different reports, two different inspections.
Okay, and the inspection you just described was related to the Dakota Westmoreland Company report?
Yes.
Okay, and that occurred in 2009.
Yes.
And you're saying you did a field investigation with respect to the Coyote Creek Mine AVF determination?
More recently, yes.
And when did that occur?
That was prior to the permit submittal. Mr. Braun, did you want to know the date of the report submittal or our inspection?
Your
date?
Inspection.
Yeah, okay. I don't have that with me right now.
You know, generally just in the last year, what time of year?
It had been probably a good year or year and a half ago.
Okay.
That'd be my best, probably more than a year and a half ago or so at least.
Do you know who was present for that field investigation?
It was myself, for sure. I know Randy Kowalski from our staff was there. I think Bill Gunnarsson also, who was also on that first. The three of us, for sure.
Okay. And this investigation was specifically for the Coyote Creek mining permit we're here talking about today, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And do you recall what sections of land or what areas you conducted the investigation on?
We generally try to key in on areas that we think that are the best looking spots for what we would consider to be sub irrigation. We look for the best spots, and I know we generated a report from that inspection also. A copy, I'm sure, which we can give you. But at least six or seven stops to the north, mostly to the north and to the south. Several of the stops were along Knife River and confluences of tributary drainages to the Knife River, as well as down south where Beaver Creek dumps into Coyote Creek.
So was any of that investigation conducted along Coyote Creek itself?
Not much of it. A little bit down south and a little bit to the north.
And can you just describe for us what you did during that investigation?
During that particular investigation? Before we went on the investigation, we had chosen a handful of different spots that we definitely and absolutely wanted to take a look at, and that's what we did. When we do these investigations, we allow either the mining company or or the consultant who put their report together, we allow them to come with, which is also what we did at the DWC during the DWC field investigation. And I believe Dr. Bickle was along on that one. And Dr. Bickle, myself, Randy Kowalski, Bill Gunnarsson, best of my ability. So that, to answer your question more directly, at least a half a dozen spots that we stopped, checked out stream channels, vegetation, any cropland growing, any evidence of sub-irrigation, if there is any, and took lots of probably 100 photographs. And similar to the DWC AVF report, we write an inspection report based on our findings.
Did you take any soil samples during that investigation?
I don't think we did on that one.
Okay.
I would have to look back at the report. I haven't looked at that. So.
Do you have exhibit number 13 in front of you up there? It's the David Bickle report.
Yes, I do.
Can I have you turn to Exhibit C?
The report I've got is just one. That's my own copy. I don't have. I don't think I have any of the exhibits with included in this. I guess I don't know what. Yes, sir.
Okay. And what I'd like is just to see if you're able to be a little bit more specific by pointing to specific sections here. If you can tell us the more recent field investigation with respect to the Coyote Creek mine application, if you can point out on here what sections you were in when you were doing the field investigation.
I'm going to start down south, and well, it doesn't really say it, but Beaver Creek dumps into Antelope Creek way down in the northeast quarter of Section 7.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then most of the other stops were to the west and northwest. You can see some areas of cropland, some strip cropping there that jumps out. Just to the west of the black line at the northwest corner of the map.
Okay, so we're up in town.
It's along the Knife River.
In the cropland you're referring to is?
In Section 16 and the east half of Section 21.
Okay.
Those couple of areas there. I know there's a couple of other spots. There was, continuing around to the west, there was at least three more stops where Brush Creek dumps in into the Knife River. I know there was one stop to the north and northwest of the Coyote Station power plant, also a valley floor, but not an alluvial valley floor in the SMACRA terms, but so that's at least three or four or five six spots up along that north and west sides of that study area.
Okay, so the last few spots you talked about were to the north-northwest of the stripes of cropland in Section 16 and 17?
Yes.
Okay. And I apologize, but did you say you did not take any soil samples during this field investigation?
I don't think we did.
Okay. in going back to the 2009 field investigation for Dakota West Moreland, you took soil samples in cropland. Is that right?
Yes.
And why did you do that specifically in cropland areas?
We picked, we looked at air photography, and the most prominent feature that jumps out along that whole valley is that cropland tract, sections 19 and 30. And Coyote Creek runs adjacent to the whole thing, and it actually splits a couple of other cropland tracts. And we zeroed in on that. We knew we wanted to get a handful of soil samples. We know there's decent access to it. Mr. Voigt had just planted corn there a couple, 3 weeks previous, and we just zeroed in on that area.
And you took soil samples to a depth of about 18 inches?
Yep.
And what were you looking for specifically in those soil samples?
The two soil scientists that were with us, number one, they were both soil classifiers, or I guess maybe still are registered soil classifiers, but number one, they wanted to determine what is the soils, and Mercer County also has those soils along that valley listed as straw loam and shambo loam, and in particular, they wanted to reconfirm that's actually what we were looking at there. And number two, like I had mentioned before, redox conditions or modeling conditions indicative also of sub-irrigated soils.
And so in looking for redox or the modeling conditions, you would have had to have had sub-irrigation rising to a level of within 18 inches of the surface in order to discover that in the soil samples you took.
Well, I don't think so. I think your expert witness and testified, and I think everybody else knows about Dr. Bickle also talked about capillary rise, and which could be several feet according to Chuck Norris and others, and even the OSM guidelines talks about capillary rise. So, even in those areas of capillary rise, redox conditions will be apparent.
Okay, and I apologize, I'll be more specific. The area in which you see capillary rise, is it fair to refer to that as the capillary zone?
I think most people would refer to it as the vadose zone.
Vadose, okay. Yep. So in looking for the indications of sub-irrigation, redox, or modeling, you would only have found those had the vadose zone risen to a level of within 18 inches of the surface?
In that particular instance, yes. We did have some other information, though.
What information?
Well, it was in the report, the 2009 DWC report, but water level information from the alluvial aquifer. And the 1970 Mercer County geologic report took water levels from two wells at, which was back then, I think, the Murray home, and apparently the Voigt home now, and alluvial water levels of 16 and 18 feet below surface, and apparently, the folks from DWC had interviewed Casey, and Mr. Voigt had told them that the water levels at the wells, the alluvial wells at his place, were 15 and 20 feet deep.
What's the location of the wells you're discussing right now?
I think one was north of the house. I think I've heard it's been covered up by the landslide or whatever. I think one was to the north of the house and the other was to the south, both near the center of Section 31. I think maybe one just barely into the northwest quarter and the other into the southwest quarter.
And how many measurements were taken from those wells?
I think for that 1970 report, I think probably just one measurement from each well.
Did you say 1970 report?
That's right. Yeah, the Oliver Mercer County Geologic and Water Resources reports, and I think they just took the one measurement from each of the wells, and then that business about 15 to 20 feet, that would have been information that Mr. Voigt had apparently given to Greg Smeestad, who was the consultant that put the 2009 AVF report together.
So the actual readings from the wells relied upon were taken in 1970?
No, those two, yes, the 16 and 18 feet, that's correct. And but of course the Casey Voigt depths that they provided would have been recent, I mean as 2009. Sure.
And how many readings did Mr. Voigt take that were reported to you?
We're going by what he had reported to Mr. Smeestad, and whether he received those different water levels, you know, in the recent past, or if he's known, you know, several times during the year, I don't know. And we're going by, I guess we're holding Mr. Smeestad to his word. He has no reason to lie to us whatsoever.
Your Honor. Could we identify, I think, if I'm right, they're talking about your exhibit, the Dakota's Westmoreland Report on the AVF. And can we identify the exhibit number? Derek?
Yeah. From early on? I can find it if you don't.
And the witness could have a copy to help refresh his recollection if you have one available.
You want to give him a copy of Voigt Exhibit Number 3?
Yeah, one deal.
Thank you.
Do you know if Mr. Voigt ever took any actual readings from a well?
I don't know about it personally. No, sir.
Okay. Do you know what time of year the readings were taken from the wells back in 1970?
No, but that information's available in the report. I don't know offhand. No, I don't. I do know that in the DWC report, they had referenced that particular report, and water levels and depths, and I do know that I checked it out, just make sure that they were in there, and yes, they were.
The field study that you conducted in 2009 related to the Dakota Westmoreland report was conducted in sections 19 and 30, is that right?
Yes.
And the more recent field investigation you conducted was... You were not in Section 31 during that investigation, right?
That is correct.
I've handed everyone a copy of North Dakota Administrative Code, Section 69, 5.208.13, and primarily just so everyone has this for the sake of reference. Mr. Beachy, are you familiar with these regulations?
I am.
Okay. And so if we turn to page 15 of the document, there are a number of subparagraphs, A through F, and it's my understanding that it's a combination of these things required to be in an investigation or report regarding the existence of alluvial valley floors. Is that fair?
Sure.
Okay. With respect to either the Dakota Westmoreland study in 2009, or your more recent field investigation, or the study for the Coyote Creek mining permit, in subsection A, it says that you need to have a mapping of the probable alluvial valley floor, including geologic maps of unconsolidated deposits, delineating the stream-laid deposits. Was that part of what was included in the investigation?
I think in that report, I think they did have a cross section in there, but I'm pretty sure they did not have a mapping of the alluvial valley.
Okay.
And in
either the Dakota Westmoreland report or more recent reports for the Coyote Creek mining permit, I'll refer you to subsection D, which requires documentation that areas identified in this section are or are not sub-irrigated based on groundwater monitoring data, representative water quality, soil moisture measurements, and measurements of rooting depth, soil modeling, and water requirements of vegetation. Were any of these included in the investigations in 2009 or the more recent one for the Coyote Creek mining permit?
I think all of those elements were touched on.
Can you point me to where they were?
In the DWC report?
In either that or the materials for the Coyote Creek mining permit?
Or when you say the materials in the Coyote Creek mining permit, you mean the 1302 permit?
Yes. Or the materials submitted for the AVF determination prior to the application for that permit?
Yes. That is the case.
And can you identify, for example, the documentation that areas identified in this section are or not sub-irrigated based on groundwater monitoring data?
Well, generally speaking, we're going with the information that was available in the report, and the 1983 and 85 OSM guidelines. And even our rules stipulate that information required to put this initial AVF report together only needs to be either easily obtainable or readily obtainable data. And looking back in the reports, all of the elements that are laid out there are discussed.
Was any color infrared photography utilized to determine if certain areas were sub-irrigated?
There was.
And at what time was that done?
It would have been back in the 1983 to 85 time period, I think probably in September of the year.
So the infrared photography used to determine areas that may or may not be sub-irrigated was from one time in September in 1980. What was it?
Either between 1983 and 1985. It was an OSM product, and it's a corresponding product with their 1983 Alluvial Valley Floor Study and Guidelines document that we have been talking about. It's two books.
Okay, and so the other one that you're referring to was the reconnaissance report from OSM?
Yes.
Okay, and I just want to make sure we're clear. We had an earlier exhibit, and I don't know if you have it up there, but it was, I believe, a 1985 OSM reconnaissance report on alluvial valley floors.
Yes.
Do you have a copy of that up there?
No, I don't.
Okay. Were you here for the testimony at the prior 2 days of hearings when that report was discussed? Do you recall that report indicating the likelihood of sub-irrigation along Coyote Creek?
Yes, and in fact, any areas that it showed potential AVF areas is what it did, and actually even, and Coyote Creek was one of those areas, and probably rightfully so. So was Knife River. But the stretch of Knife River to the west and going all the way to the east of where Coyote Creek is was categorically excluded from AVF status in the very same report where the map shows that it's potential AVF. And the reason it was categorically excluded was because of the deeply incised nature of the stream channel.
But the only infrared photography that you relied on in either of the reports was the infrared photography from that report, which found the likelihood of subirrigation.
We've got the actual color air photos up in our office.
That's all the questions I have, but I do need to make a note that we had at one point requested anything that the PSC was relying on with respect to the AVF determination or this permit, and we have not received, we have now received a report from the 2009 investigation, and in Alana's defense, she did say that they didn't mean to not give that to us. But I also understand now that with respect to the 1985 reconnaissance report, there are infrared photos that were relied on which are not in the record and which we don't have possession of. And we were also not aware of the field investigation conducted more recently and the report generated from that, all of which should have been given to us in response to our request. So if nothing else, I just need to note that for the record, and I hope that we can possibly get copies of those.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
We have no objection to providing copies of the two field inspection reports, the 09 one and the more recent one, and we can even make those exhibits. I'm not real sure. I'd have to confer with Jim. I mean, I think the photos are upstairs, but I'm not real sure how we would produce them for the record and the right size and all of that or digitally, but anything would be available. I will say in defense of all of us here at the staff, we did have a records request, and we did provide what we thought was the entire volume of data that was relied upon to analyze this permit and the turnaround time given the holiday and everything. This was before, but, you know, December was a busy month. We didn't have a lot of time to turn it around. We did think we included everything, and we are happy to include these at this point.
Happy to include the...
I mean, we can make them exhibits or we can just provide them to the parties, whatever the parties prefer.
What are you asking for, Mr. Broughton?
I guess at this juncture, if there's no objection, what I would like is... they did provide as a potential exhibit the 2009 report. If following the hearing they could provide the more recent report and let us take a look at these aerial photographs and make a determination, and we could file them as a late filed exhibit if we choose to do that. I guess that's the way I would propose to do it, just for efficiency's sake, if nothing else.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle, your thoughts on that approach?
We find that acceptable.
Okay. Mr. Biella?
When you say more recent report, are you referring to the DWC?
No.
Determination?
No, and I'm sorry, Alana, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding from Mr. Beachy's testimony is that there was a more recent field investigation and a report generated from that specifically with respect to the Coyote Creek mining permit AVF determination that we don't have a copy of.
That's correct. There's... the company is submitting the report about whether they think they have an AVF coming up or not. And then the staff goes out, and the staff pretty much documents everything they ever do in reclamation. So they document that visit, that field inspection. And so there is a sort of a memo on that.
Yeah.
Jim.
Go ahead, Mr. Hooch.
Yeah, I just want to explain about those two field reports. I guess what I copied for you, Derek, was what everything we had in our official file for this. And it happened that these two memos following these field inspections were in a different directory that I wasn't aware of until Bruce had given me a copy of the one from 2009 and realized that that was in his personal directory rather than the directory for this.
I guess I just want to say I wasn't trying to cast aspersions, and I certainly understand the short turnaround time, and I'm not implying that there was any intent to withhold anything here. I'm just saying that at this point I'm aware of them and I'd like to see them.
No, we'll get those to you.
One more thing. Mr. Biella, the second memo would be very much like the first one that I sent out the other day saying I think this might be an exhibit, only it would be a more recent date. Okay.
Okay, so upon conclusion of the hearing, the advisory staff will make the two reports or documents available in addition to the photographs, and at that point, the parties will decide amongst themselves whether or not there's a need to have those offered and admitted as late-filed exhibits, correct? Okay.
Correct.
Any further examination of the witness, Mr. Broughton?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Biella?
Just a couple, Your Honor. Bruce, referring to the regulation that was just handed out, if you look at the last sentence on page 14, it says studies performed during the investigation by the applicant or subsequent studies required of the applicant must include an appropriate combination, emphasizing an appropriate combination, adapted to site-specific conditions of, and it has A through F. I would interpret that to read, you don't necessarily have to include A through F. You have to provide an appropriate combination. Would that be a correct reading of that?
That'd be correct. And I think what it really boils down to is once we receive that report, if we require more information, this gives us the power to ask for that information.
And my last question, have you seen any evidence presented at this hearing which would indicate that an AVF is present in Cayo Creek?
No.
I have no further questions.
Commissioner Christman?
Earlier I asked, I think Mr. Bickle, about the groundwater tests at nighttime versus daytime and some other recommendations that had been made in previous days' testimony, and his response was that they weren't necessary because the potential for AVF had already been ruled out. I guess I'm just re-asking in a different way Mr. Biella's last question. And in hindsight, do you think that our team should have done more to investigate this before coming up with a determination, or are you still comfortable in your determination based on the evidence that you put together and the inspections that you did do?
I am very comfortable with the determination. I would be absolutely unable to defend a positive AVF determination. I know that. And the determination that we have come up with is correct. Getting to your question specifically about monitoring wells and that kind of stuff. And one mining company did it, South Hart, a coal mine here several years ago, and during the AVF report, we did not require that data. They voluntarily provided data, whereas these monitoring wells, they're 2-inch plastic pipe in alluvium, and they install pressure recording transducers, and they could record water levels every second or 10 seconds, wherever you want to set it, or every 5 minutes if you want. And you can, and it will record diurnal fluctuation, and which would be a response to rise in the water level of the alluvial aquifer getting towards sundown because of the loss of evapotranspiration from plants that are actually being able to use sub-irrigated water from the alluvial aquifer. And they provided that information of their own volition. We didn't require it. And in this particular instance, and that was the one and only time that that type of information has been made available. There are alluvial monitoring wells out at Kyle Creek right now. If for us to have required DWC to go down into Kyle Creek Valley and install groundwater monitoring wells, it just wouldn't make any sense. They're mining a half a mile away, way up on the hill, and they're going to have absolutely no effect to Kyle Creek. And that, quite frankly, the same is can be said for the Kyle Creek coal mine.
No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, Bruce, for your testimony. When there is an AVF determination, how is that mitigated in the mining permit, or how do we deal with those?
If there is an AVF determination, and actually there are some types of there are two different types of AVFs that can be mined through and reclaimed or restored. Other AVFs cannot be mined through, but there are certain essential hydrologic functions that need to be maintained. That would be the water resources that are providing the value. Because of that alluvial valley floor status, need to be retained or restored. And there are, once a site is determined to be of AVF status, and that's when these different monitoring wells and all that kind of stuff go in, there's various levels of monitoring and protection and restoration that's required. Over and above what would normally be considered in the permit application.
Okay. In terms of the hydrologic resources in this area, talk to me about your confidence in reclaiming them, the ability of the company to reclaim them post-mining.
I don't know that it's actually been done in the United States, and I guess I need to make it perfectly clear that this valley floor, Coyote Creek Valley floor, is not going to be mined, and not even close. The coal seam that's going to be mined averages 75 feet higher than the valley floor, and I don't think there's going to be any stockpiles. There's not going to be any sediment ponds. The only thing going across that valley is going to be two access roads, one from the shop office and the other would be the haul road to take coal to the Coyote Station power plant.
Okay, so now you're presenting me with information I either I'm not understanding or I didn't realize. So Section 30 and Section 31 are not going to be mined?
Absolutely not. There's no coal there.
So what are we concerned about then in terms of the reclamation of those areas? What reclamation will there be?
Well, I think you know, it's been kind of fragmented, the various different subjects that have been discussed here. The reclamation is definitely not talking about down in the valley floor. It's up on top where the coal is going to get removed.
Okay. I don't have any more questions.
Commissioner Kolk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Bruce, for that last bit of testimony. I've been hoping that would come out for the last day. You laid it out perfectly what's going on out there. I just have one, I guess, thought. And you talked about it you recited almost perfectly what, not so much Mr. Bickel's conclusion, but the conclusion of the 1985 where it said that, however the report recognized correctly the deeply incised channel and lack of AVF potential of the Knife River Valley and Elm Creek to Spring Creek. So what I'm trying to walk through is that, the way I read that is that if someone walks out in this ground that is trained in hydrology and soil science, they'll be able to quickly determine whether there's even the potential of AVF. The way I look at that, if you're an expert and you walk this ground, you're going to know right away.
It's I don't know if I'd quite agree with that. It's complex. There's the 1983 report is 300 pages long, and a lot of that is about, you know, the definition and identification of an alluvial valley floor, and a lot of it is also descriptive of what is not an alluvial valley floor. And so it's not quite a cakewalk, but generally speaking, in this region, in this area of North Dakota, and Dr. Bickel spoke to this too, but we just really don't see AVF like we do down in northeast Wyoming, southeast Montana, Utah, and New Mexico. And if you can just picture scrubland and sagebrush and then dropping down into a valley floor where they're actually able to get some hay production for cattle, that would give you a good picture of what a true AVF in the statutory and regulatory definition of SMCRA is all about.
Would you agree that if someone walks the ground then and has, if you have the data available to you and you walk the ground, you're going to be able to make a better determination than if you just have the data available to you?
Yep, and that's why we bring soils people and vegetation specialists with us when we do these investigations.
Were you in the room when Mr. Norris testified?
I was.
Do you recall my question to him about his thoughts on whose opinion I should value better, someone who just looked at the data or someone who walked the ground? Do you remember what his answer was?
I think he said whoever had boots on the ground would be the one.
All right. Thank you. That's no further questions.
Okay.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
We have no questions.
Okay. Mr. Broughton?
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Beachy, during your investigations, did you ever have your boots on the ground of Section 31?
I could have. I may have gotten close. It's possible that I wasn't in. Well, I know I've been across Section 31. You can drive, you know, the access to the void's place, of course. So I'd have been there and looked at it, I guess.
The study area for the 2009 investigation report indicates that it was Sections 19 and 30. Is that right?
That's what we zeroed in on, yes.
Okay. And you mentioned that Section 31 is not going to be mined. Is it your testimony that the AVF determination is less important in areas that are adjacent to the mined area rather than actually in the mine?
No, No, it would not be I would not testify to that. There are instances where mining operations can affect water supply to an alluvial aquifer or an AVF, and so the answer to that would be no.
Okay, so you're looking at Section 31 specifically because of the concern that the hydrological balance could be impacted such that the AVF, if it exists in Section 31, would be impacted.
I think, okay, could you maybe rephrase that? Maybe I can boil it down for you. I don't think any of the essential hydrologic functions associated with Coyote Creek Valley, whether it's an AVF or not, whether we term it an AVF or not, doesn't matter. We've seen through at all of the other mines in North Dakota, and they're all mining next to creeks and rivers and all, and there has been absolutely no relationship between coal mining and alluvial water aquifer water levels. They rise and fall with precipitation trends.
So the fact that you haven't seen an impact on an AVF before means that you're less concerned about the accuracy of your AVF determinations?
Not at all. We take these very seriously, and that's why we get a truck full of guys to go out, and they have their own specialty. We take them all very seriously. I, for one, thought we might have half a chance to see some sub-irrigation here, but it's just not there.
Why was it significant to you that there's no mining occurring in Section 31?
Why is it significant to me? None of Coyote Creek Valley is going to get mined. There's no coal under there until you get way deep. The Upper Beulah Coal Seam, which is the bed that Coyote Creek Mine is going after, is up on the high ground off to the west. And that valley floor, the coal that was there, has been washed out thousands of years ago and replaced with alluvium.
And is the information you just relayed to me pertinent because you think that if there were an AVF in Section 31, it wouldn't be impacted by mining activities?
Okay, could you rephrase that one again?
You've essentially indicated that you don't believe there's any concern that mining activities outside of Section 31 would impact an AVF if it existed in Section 31, right?
That would be my testimony, yes.
And the reason you bring that up, the fact that you don't think it's going to have an impact, is because you're not as concerned about whether an AVF exists because you don't believe that it would be impacted if it was there or not.
Whether an AVF, whether we term this area an AVF or not, it is going to require the same protections, the same hydrologic performance parameters, and all requirements that that the rest of the coal mine that's in the permit receives, and off-permit areas too.
So your testimony is that there's no special protections for AVF?
There absolutely is. That's why everybody is going through this whole rigmarole to try and determine what AVF is and is not.
I just want to follow up on one thing. You had mentioned that the Dakota West Moreland Company, when they were doing their report, they were mining a ways away as well. Was that correct?
That's correct. Yes.
What was the reason that Dakota West Moreland Company had to obtain an AVF determination in 2009?
Because any time that a mine permit area is within or adjacent to a substantial stream valley, which Kyle Creek is, no doubt about it. An adjacent area can range between half a mile and a mile. And they actually came in with the revision to add land with revision 22, and we said, wait a minute here, before you can do this, you need to do this AVF.
So the land that they were going to actively mine was within a half a mile to a mile of the Cavity Creek Valley?
Eventually. They're not there yet, but they're getting there.
No further questions.
Mr. Biella.
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Chrisman.
We never know who all is watching our broadcasts. When you've talked about doing your own testing in sections 30 and 19, I think 19 might sound to a lot of people like it's somewhere a long ways away, but on a map is section 30 right immediately above section 31 that's under discussion, and section 19 right immediately above section 30?
Yeah.
Okay, just wanted to point that out.
Yeah.
No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
No more questions.
Commissioner Kalk?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything further?
I just have one question, Mr. Beachy. In that discussion that you were having and you had to ask a couple of times for the question to be repeated, and you were commenting about how no actual coal is under Section 31 and that actual mining would not be occurring there, I'd like you to again summarize whether that had any impact on the type of AVF investigation or determination that you make, the fact that it wouldn't actually be mined.
Well, if there was coal under there, and if it was AVF, if we determined it to be AVF, they could certainly mine it. It would cost them a lot more money. It would be time consuming, and they would have to go through the restoration process of the essential hydrologic functions, and which in effect would be cost prohibitive.
But I was asking about in your determination of whether or not there is an AVF pre-permit, does the fact that the permit planning is going to include actual mining there or not, does that have anything to do with how you approach a determination and an investigation of whether to, something is AVF or not?
No, it doesn't.
Thank you.
Mr. Broughton, any follow-up on that?
Just one question. My microphone's dead. I'll try to be loud.
Let's get a different one.
Hang on. It streams over the internet as well, so we need to make sure that you're picked up.
You just indicated that that doesn't have any impact on your determination of AVF?
It would not.
Okay, why not?
Why not? Because when we're going to go look at an area, even if for example, they a large permit area, if they don't plan to mine a certain stream channel, which they don't, but maybe even down the road, 20 years or whatever, plans may change. And, you know, if there's coal under a stream valley, the potential is there to be mined. So really, we're going into this with an open mind, and that's what I have to say.
I have nothing further.
Okay. Mr. Biella?
No, you're up.
Commissioner Chrisman?
No.
Commissioner Fedorchak? Commissioner Kolk? Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything else with this witness?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. You can step down. Are you ready to call your next witness?
Yes, Dean Mose.
Mr. Mose, you're subject to the same oath, and I'm required to give you the same admonition with respect to the penalty for perjury. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both, and being advised of the penalty for perjury. Do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Mose, could you state your name, spell your last name, and provide your address, please?
Dean Mose, M-O-O-S. I work for the Public Service Commission, State Capitol, 600 East Boulevard, Bismarck, North Dakota.
And your position with the commission?
I am currently the Assistant Director of the Reclamation Division.
And you were previously qualified as a soil science expert. And did you have occasion to work on either the predetermination of AVF for this particular mine and or the mine permit for this particular mine?
Yes, I did.
Could you tell me in your own words, please, some information about your approach? It was mentioned by Mr. Beachy that you had accompanied him on the field investigation. So your approach and work and conclusions regarding the AVF issue, please?
Sure. When the 2009 investigation was done in Section 19, I was out on that. I was along to look at the soils. The soil survey information that was provided in the AVF study indicated it was straw soil. And as Mr. Beachy indicated, we verified, that was the purpose of the holes, was to verify that it is a straw soil. Straw soils are a floodplain soil. They developed in stream-laid deposits. They're a highly productive soil, high organic matter. Their level soils are good cropland. In fact, in Mercer County, they're considered prime farmland. Then with regard to the later Coyote Creek investigation, I was not out on the field investigation, but I did review the soils information that was provided for that study. And that also, again, indicated that the primary soils along the Coyote Creek drainage, the floodplain soils were straw soils. Straw is just a common name for the soils there. The bulk of the soils along Coyote Creek are the straw soils. And again, like I said, I was not out on the investigation there, but verified, reviewed the information that was provided in that investigation.
The person who was the soils person on that investigation, is that person in the room today?
No. That would be Bill Gunnarsson, I believe, was out on that.
Okay. Did the information lead you to conclude anything about to assist the staff in making its recommendation or conclusions about whether or not an AVF existed?
Well, in reviewing it, I verified with the Mercer County Soil Survey that there were indeed straw soils there, and that's what they are mapped as, the floodplain soils, that they were indeed straw soils. And, again, this was verified by our field investigation back in 2009. And reviewing, I reviewed the soils interpretation data for the straw soils. Straw soils are a deep soil, like I said, high organic matter, medium textured. But what was of most importance was the depth to groundwater. The NRCS provides interpretive data for each soil map unit, and the Mercer County Soil Survey indicates the depth to water table for straw soil at greater than 80 inches. 80 inches is the depth to which they provide interpretations. They do not provide interpretations below 80 inches. So because they say it's greater than 80 inches doesn't mean it's 80 inches, but it's at least greater than 80 inches.
And what does that tell you about AVFs, if anything?
It would indicate to me that it's not sub-irrigation, that it's at least 80 inches below the surface to the groundwater table, as provided by the NRCS and the later detailed soil survey that was done for the permit, for permit 1302.
This next question is slightly out of order, and I apologize, but I'm starting to glaze over. I should have asked you for a very quick summary of your soil experience and expertise before we got into that discussion.
All right. I have a Bachelor in Soil Science degree from North Dakota State University in 1978. For first 7 years of my career, I mapped soils for the was then known as the Soil Conservation Service in both Grant County, North Dakota, and Cavalier County, North Dakota. I then worked for a short time for an agricultural consultant as a soil specialist, and then went to work for the Health Department for 2 years. And since 1988, I worked for the Public Service Commission. And early on, the first 15-plus years of my career here, my area of responsibility was soils and prime farmland.
And your area of responsibility today?
More administrative, inspection, enforcement, administrative, but I still have keep my fingers in the soils and prime farmland issues.
Do you work on the mining plans in permit applications and the reclamation plans as it relates to soils?
Sure. Review the plans as they come in. You know, staff reviews them, and we review their reviews, if you will.
So did you work on this particular permit application in that regard?
I did.
And do you have any conclusions, or can you explain to the commission your conclusions as far as recommending approval of the permit as it relates to soil reclamation?
The methods that they're proposing are similar to what are used at other mines, and we found those to be adequate. There has been bond release at the other mines. This permit came up a little short, as Sarah indicated earlier, that they had a 32-inch average salvage depth for Mr. Voigt's land, and that they will be identifying additional material to provide a full 48-inch respread, what is the maximum required by the law.
So you've heard the 3 days of hearing so far on this case, correct?
Correct.
Much of which was about soil health and reclamation. Mm-hmm. As Commissioner asked the previous witness, what did you hear anything in that other testimony to lead you to conclude that there were any errors or any tweaks that should be made to this permit regarding the soil reclamation and health?
No. You know, reclamation is an evolving science. It certainly is. And as time goes on, if there's always the opportunity for improvement, and even the short time that I've been here, there's been improvements made to alleviate compaction, address soil health, the use of winter annuals to relieve compaction. So there's steps being made. It's an evolving science.
Are those incorporated into this particular plant permit reclamation plan?
Well, some of the features are, especially with regard to soil handling to reduce compaction, some of those things.
That's all the questions that we have.
Mr. Broughton.
Mr. Moose, you indicated that you had looked at the specific soil types. Did you look at the soil types in Section 31?
No, I did not. The time we were there in 2009, we stayed up in Section 19 and 30.
Do you recall the specific soil type or types that you found in 19 and 30?
Straw on the lower lying terraces, the lower floodplain position. And then as it grades up to the west, it grades towards a Chambeau soil, which is even a higher soil, not nearly as productive soil as the straw soil.
Is there a difference between straw and straw loam soil?
Straw and straw loam. All the loam refers just to the surface texture. They're both medium textured.
And tell me again what the soil type tells you about the existence of sub-irrigation.
Well, straw is typically not a sub-irrigated soil. It's considered a well-drained soil. And like I said, I went to the interpretations in the Mercer County Soil Survey, and it says the depth of the water table is greater than 80 inches.
And so the sub-irrigation characteristics that are tied to the soil types are created by the, is it created by the Soil Conservation Service?
I believe so.
Okay. Do you have the OSM Alluvial Valley Floor Identification and Study Guidelines in front of you?
Not in front of me.
Mr. Broughton, just identify that exhibit again.
This is Voigt exhibit number 15.
Okay, thank you.
I direct your attention to the paragraph under general definitions. It states that Soil Conservation Service definition of naturally sub-irrigated area is land with an effective subsurface groundwater table and water rarely over the surface during the growing season. Now, at the beginning of this paragraph, it states that sub-irrigation in terms of the Alluvial Valley Floor Regulatory Program is the supplying of water to plants from underneath or from a semi-saturated or saturated zone where water is available for use by vegetation, referring to SMACRA regulations.
Could we just get a quick reference to what page you're on there?
I'm sorry, it's C1, Appendix C1. Mr. Moose, the definition of sub-irrigation used by the Soil Conservation Service is different than that used by SMACRA, isn't it?
Sub-irrigation, it might be different wording, but I think it implies the same thing.
So those definitions to you mean the same thing?
I believe so.
Okay. Are Are you aware of how soil is classified into clay, loam, and sand? Is that familiar to you?
Yes.
Can you explain that for us a little bit?
It refers to the relative proportion of sand, silt, and clay particles, a loam being a mixture of all. Of course, a silty clay is a mixture of silt and clay. Fine sandy loam is a mixture of all of them.
And do you know what combination or individual soil types, the clay, sand, or loam, are more conducive to capillary rise?
Loams probably would be the highest capillary rise, or the finer textured.
And finer textured, you mean clay would be finer textured, right?
Correct.
So would a clay loam to loam be the most conducive to capillary rise?
Probably.
Okay. And Mr. Moose, are you familiar with the Webb Soil Survey?
Yes, I am.
And have you ever printed out maps of soil types from the Webb Soil Survey?
Yes, I have.
Okay, and so do you recognize the map that I've given you?
Yes, this is portion of Section 31, including the Voigt Farmstead. It's very similar to a map that I had produced for myself.
Okay, and so this would be an accurate map printed out from the Webb Soil Survey of Section 31, in your opinion?
Yes.
Okay, and I have not marked this, and I'm not sure where we're at on Voigt for numbers.
It would be Voigt Exhibit 16.
So I would mark that and offer this as Voigt Exhibit 16.
Mr. Biella?
And am I correct in understanding this is printed from the Natural Resources Conservation Service website?
Correct.
No objection.
Ms. Jeff Kotsacko?
No objection, but we're just talking about the map part, not the other document right now, right?
It's my understanding.
Derek?
Yeah, I can go through the rest, I guess. Mr. Moose, when you print out a map from the Webb Soil Survey...
Did not have an objection?
No objection.
All right.
No.
So Voigt Exhibit 16 is admitted. Now you can continue. Go ahead.
When you print out a map from the Webb Soil Survey, does it typically come with a legend attached to it?
Yes, you can print the legend separate from that, from your area of interest, what they call the area of interest.
And then the third page also, the map unit legend, is also something that you can print along with that map?
Correct.
And for simplicity's sake, I'd offer all three pages as a Voigt Exhibit number 16 as a single exhibit. If I can do that at this point, otherwise I will mark them as 17 and 18.
I think all of the stapled three pages can be considered part of exhibit number 16. Any objection to that, Mr. Biella?
No, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sagel?
No, thank you.
Yeah, that's all considered exhibit, void exhibit 16.
Thank you. And Mr. Moose, are you also familiar with the more detailed descriptions of the soil types that you can access through the Web Soil Survey?
Yes, I am.
And if you look at the other document I've handed you, can you, are you able to identify this?
It appears to be the map unit description. I'm guessing it's probably a generic description there, and then it appears to go on to the detailed description for the straw loam map unit.
And that map unit is E4161A?
Correct.
And if you look at Exhibit 16, does that roughly correspond to the alfalfa fields of Mr. Voigt?
It does.
Okay. I would offer the map unit description as Voigt number 17.
Mr. Biella?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sagel?
No objection. Okay.
Voigt Exhibit 17 is admitted.
So, Mr. Moose, is it your understanding that this map unit description is a description of the specific soil type found in Mr. Voigt's alfalfa fields?
Yes.
Okay, and can I have you turn to page 3 of 4 of Exhibit 17, which is the map unit description?
Okay.
And the typical profile, as indicated on this, shows that from 0 to 60 inches, you have beginning a combination of loam up to 30 inches, and after that, a clay loam down to 60 inches. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's what you indicated would be most conducive to capillary rise?
Correct.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Biella?
Dean, looking at Exhibit 17, page 3, under properties and qualities, It says depth to water table, more than 80 inches. That seems to support your testimony you previously gave. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Commissioner Chrisman?
No other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any questions either. Thanks, Dean.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Dean, for your testimony. Just one thought. In your opinion, do you believe soil type is a significant factor in AVF determination?
It's certainly part of it. It's you know, a number of things go into make up an AVF, and you use different things to arrive at that determination, and soils is certainly one of them.
But if you had a certain soil type that was, well, for example, I'll go back, go back to the exhibit we just talked about. Exhibit 17 talks about frequency of flooding rare, frequency of ponding none. That would just reinforce even more that the availability of AVF in this area probably is low.
Based on the soils.
So if there was a soil type that differed to that, that could, I don't even need to go down that road, so thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sagel?
We have no further questions.
Okay. You can step down, thank you. Just, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sagel, before you call your next witness, I think just want to make an announcement. Mr. Nitschke reminded me that the Capitol doors are secured at 5:30. Is that correct? And after that point, they need to go through you to...
They need to be carted open so the alarms
no, they, go off. No, yeah, they don't go off.
Yeah, they do.
So I guess, bottom line, if you plan to leave after 5:30, let Mr. Nitschke know so he can make sure you get out without setting off the alarms.
Security is aware.
All right. Go ahead. You can call your next witness.
I'll call Jim Deitch.
Good
Mr. Deutsch, I'm required to give you the oath, and I'm required as well to advise you of the penalty for perjury, Class C felony in North Dakota, punishable by maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Deitch, could you state your name, spell your last name, give us your address, and where you work, please?
This, name is Jim Deitch. Last name is spelled D-E-U-T-S-C-H. And I'm the director of the Reclamation and Abandoned Mine Lands Divisions for the Public Service Commission. My work address is 600 East Boulevard Avenue, Bismarck, North Dakota.
Thank you. And can you give us a summary of your qualifications and experience?
Well, I have a soils degree from NDSU, dating back here, I guess, more than 40 years now, and been employed with the commission in the Reclamation Division, starting out there since July of 1974. Started initially as a reclamation inspector, environmental scientist, then back in the late 80s, became assistant director of the Reclamation Division. And in 1997, became director of the Reclamation Division. Then in 2006, also picked up the responsibilities as director of the Abandoned Mine Land Division.
So how many years of experience do you have in federal and state mining, mining permitting and reclamation?
It's over 40 years now.
Is it safe to say you have a great familiarity with both the federal requirements and the state requirements?
Yes, I do, and in fact was involved with a team that wrote the state and federal, the state law and rules following enactment of the federal surface mining law in 1977.
So can you tell us, you have been here for the full 3 days of hearings also, and you have heard the testimony, correct?
Yes, I have.
And can you tell us in your own words what you heard as the issues that the landowner has brought to the attention of the commission and how the permit application and officially approved permit has addressed those issues?
The primary issues, as I see them, is the Alluvial Valley floor determination for Coyote Creek. Other issues relate to the reclamation procedures that are used and the reestablishment of vegetation productivity, particularly on native grasslands. And with regard to the permit itself, we acknowledge in the permit approval document that there was a negative determination for the Alluvial Valley floor with regard to areas in and around Coyote Creek and the Knife River. And with regard to the reclamation standards, it was our finding that the reclamation can be accomplished as proposed by the Coyote Creek Mining Company. And in part, that's based on the practices that they've used and the successful reclamation of other lands using those techniques as evidenced by bond release. And there again, with regard to the permit approval, there's a number of findings we have to make. That's part of the permit approval document, and it's a matter of working through that the entire application process where we do our completeness technical reviews and a number of letters that went to Coyote Creek Mining Company to address items in the application to make sure all those requirements were met. And once that was done, we prepared the findings and recommended approval to the commission.
Is there anything you heard in the testimony over the course of the 3 days to make you question a permit finding or a condition, thinking that perhaps something should be tweaked or changed?
No, I don't see any reason for making any changes to the permit as approved.
There was some discussion early on about some reclamation statistics, and we did offer you to produce two spreadsheets. And I've got those marked as Exhibit 7 and 8, PSC 7 and 8. If we could get those passed out now.
Yep.
Thank you. I have two sevens. Okay. All right.
Save me a step.
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, Mr. Deitch, could you identify Exhibit 7 and tell us what it is and whether or not you prepared it, and if you did prepare it, from what data?
Exhibit 7 lists the bond release acreage that has been approved by the commission, as well as there's another column in there that lists the current permitted acreage. And this was as of October 1st of 2014, and the top half of the page, the first table lists the bond releases for lands that were permitted or re-permitted after July 1, 1979. I guess it's what we consider post-SMACRA or after the full requirements of the federal law went into effect here in North Dakota after our law was basically a new law was adopted by the 1979 legislative session. And this lists the total bond release acreage. Then we break that out by land use, and we also identify if there's undisturbed acres that are part of those bond releases. And there again, the total, I guess, as I'll call it, post-SMACRA bond release acreage is 20,800. Of that, just about 5,700 acres was undisturbed. The cropland total is a little over 4,000 acres. Hayland, nearly 1,700. More than 4,700 acres of native grassland. Then there's 163 acres of tame grassland, and then for wildlife and recreation, there's 903 acres. Industrial roads, there's over 3,000 acres. A lot of this includes areas that are used for the disposal of coal ash under health department regulation. Then there's also woodlands, ponds, and some residential area.
Did you prepare this document number PSC 7?
Yes, this is a document that was, I guess, first started preparing this here more than 10 years ago. There was different questions about amount of bond release, so we started tracking this based on the bond releases that had been approved. And in the documents that we prepare when we recommend commission approval, we include the acres of the different land uses, and it's based on that. Then also included the acres of the, I guess what we call pre-SMACRA, lands permitted before July 1, 79. And they're listed by mine, but not by land use. And there again, the way things were permitted in the earlier days, of that total of 6,223 acres listed there, nearly all of that was disturbed by mining. There may be some small areas that weren't, but for most purposes, consider most of that land mined and reclaimed as well. And some of that was subject to our earlier reclamation laws that even before topsoil requirements came into effect, the first requirements to save topsoil came into place in 1973. Then in 1975, our law was changed to require, basically ended up requiring that both topsoil and subsoil be saved. And in that law was the requirements was put into place that the intent was to restore the productivity of agricultural lands, and that's something that we have maintained that is in North Dakota law, that is not in federal law. Federal law only requires the productivity be restored on prime farmlands. On non-prime, the OSM regulations require that to be restored to 90% of the pre-mine. So with regard to restoring productivity, that is something on all agricultural land that is unique to North Dakota. And some of those lands that are listed permitted prior to 1979 would include lands that had to meet those productivity requirements. I don't have the breakdown of that. So, and as other bond releases are approved, we generally update this table, and it's frequently asked for by different groups, and that's so we maintain it.
And all of the information you're using to update it is from your own mining and permit records, correct?
It's from our records, and to say it's 100% accurate, there could be some errors, but generally it gives a good idea where things are at with regard to bond release and that. So,
I would offer Exhibit 7.
Mr. Broughton?
No objection.
Mr. Biella?
No objection.
PSC Exhibit 7 is admitted.
And then, Mr. Deitch, if you'd turn to PSC 8 and identify that and tell us who prepared it and from what data.
Okay. Exhibit 8, that gives an estimation of the lands that have been disturbed and reclaimed. And it also lists the lands that that the total permitted acreage by mine, as well as the lands by mine, which have the disturbed lands that have received final bond release. It's basically taken from the previous table. This data is based off of annual mine maps that are submitted by the mining companies. Goes back probably more than 10 years ago. We started collecting this information. It was information that the OSM wanted as part of their annual oversight. So we, from different methods, from what was reported and early on kind of perimetering areas and now more with use of GIS, that we determined the amount of lands that have been disturbed and some of the kind of the active disturbance, what we consider long-term facilities listed on that table by mine, and long-term disturbances would be the roads, the stockpiles, sedimentation ponds, the other facilities. Then the active mine areas are generally the pit areas themselves, then areas immediately in front of and some of the areas behind where topsoil, subsoil has been removed. Then areas that have been graded, that's mined areas that have been regraded and approved for soil respread, and it also includes if there's some associated disturbances. If those areas have been through the reclamation process, those areas are included as well. Then there's a listing for areas resoiled and seeded. They're getting acreage by mine. Then another table that lists the areas that have been seeded for 10 years or more. And there again, that number is calculated by going back to the annual maps from 10 years ago and looking at what the total was then that had been seeded, but then subtracting out areas that have received bond release. So it gives a pretty good idea with the status of reclamation. Of the mine lands, of those lands that have been disturbed. And like I said earlier, that we do get annual mine maps from the mining companies, and that's where this information is collected. And I guess initially I was worked on this table late, more recent years that Dean Moses has been putting together a lot of the information as well. So, but it's based on information that we get from the mining companies, and they're getting those annual mine maps. That's something that we go through and verify based on air photos, mine inspections, to try to make sure that information is correct.
I would offer Exhibit 8.
Mr. Broughton?
No objection.
Mr. Biella?
No objection.
PSC Exhibit 8 is admitted.
Mr. Deitch, I do have another question for you regarding testimony that we've heard the last few days, the 3 days of hearing. Some of the suggestions that were made by the landowner for different types of reclamation or additional standards, did you hear some that would require a change in rule? Or did you hear any that would require a change in rule?
Well, if there's going to be different standards used for determining reclamation success, if we would go to a soil health standard rather than productivity, that would not only require a change of rules, but a change in the law, because the law is very specific in stating that agricultural productivity has to be restored before we release bond.
And that was the point you were making, that our law has said that even despite SMACRA.
Yes, going back to 1975, that is correct.
Okay, that's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Broughton?
Direct your attention to Exhibit 8, Mr. Deutsch. A few questions just to clarify. In the final column here, you list all of the disturbed lands that were granted final bond release. But in the column for disturbed lands, you stop listing them after Gascoigne. And I understand that that's because those all had received final bond release. Is that right?
That is correct.
And can you just explain why you chose to represent the information that way?
Well, I represent it in the manner that I did to show the lands that are currently under permit, where lands that have or will be disturbed by listing the total permit area. Then from there, listing what of the permitted lands, what's disturbed, and this was as of the end of last year, or I should say now at the end of 2013. But it was a matter to give an indication of what the status of those disturbed lands, you know, how much is reclaimed. And I know there's been a lot of discussion with regard to areas that are still under bond, you know, what is eligible for bond release, and that column that says areas ceded for 10 years, that would indicate lands that would be potentially eligible for bond release, but provided the companies had all the data they needed to demonstrate reclamation success. But I purposely chose not to list the disturbed lands at the mines that have been totally bond released, because there's no ongoing reclamation liabilities for those mines, but to give a complete picture of what had been mined and reclaimed at those lands at those mines, I wanted this table to reflect that as well.
Okay. So you'd agree that if you wanted to know, for example, using these numbers, what percentage the disturbed lands granted final bond release were out of the total disturbed lands ever in North Dakota, you would have to add that number back into the disturbed lands total?
That would be correct.
Okay. And it appears that the largest four mines are Beulah, Center, Falkirk, and Freedom. Can you give me an idea of when each of those mines began active mining operations?
The Beulah Mine, that's their mine south of Beulah. There used to be a North Beulah Mine. In fact, there are some permitted lands there, too. But I believe that mine south of Beulah that was Knife River, now Dakota Westmoreland, that they began operations there back in the late 1960s. The Center Mine began operations in the early 70s, probably right around 1970, I believe. The Falkirk and Freedom Mines, I think the Falkirk was permitted first in, the first permit there was probably in the mid-70s. Then I think the first permit for the Freedom Mine was probably about 1977.
And so if I took the top four numbers under disturbed lands granted final bond release and divided that by the top four numbers under disturbed lands, that would give me the percentage of lands for those four mines that have been released from bond in the life of the mine?
Now, yeah, after you added back in the bond released acreage into that disturbed total, that would give you that percentage.
Sure. Well, let me ask that again. So the numbers you have for a total under disturbed lands, that does not include the amount for disturbed lands granted final bond release?
That is correct.
Okay.
And maybe that isn't real clear on the table there, but I guess with the footnote that I have there, I guess tried to clarify that. And the reason on that far right-hand column, as far as for the bond release, oftentimes there are undisturbed lands that get bond release, but that does not include any of the undisturbed. And that's the same on, I guess, the one column on that Exhibit 7 that we identify the acres that's undisturbed with the various bond releases.
So I have a calculator, and if you want to verify my math, I'd be happy to let you. But when I calculate the top four under disturbed lands granted final bond release, I come up with 5,369. And when I add that back into the top four numbers under disturbed lands, I come up with 63,096. And so when I divide the disturbed lands for bond release by the total disturbed lands, I get 8.5%. Meaning that in the entire time these four mines have been in operation, they've managed to get 8.5% of that land released from bond. Does that sound right?
That just looking at the numbers, I don't have a calculator, but that looks approximately right.
You have a number of listings under the areas ceded for 10 years, and was your testimony that represents land that is in third stage bond release?
That's not necessarily third stage bond release, but it's the lands, areas that the reclaimed lands that have been ceded for 10 years or more. So that means with our 10-year revegetation liability period that these areas would be eligible for bond release based on satisfying that requirement that they remain under bond for at least 10 years. It's a matter that we cannot release reclaimed lands from bond until that 10-year liability period is up. And this is in here, and this is a number that OSM has been interested in too, wondering what lands are eligible for bond release that haven't received it, and that's essentially what that number represents. It's that 13,639. So earlier you came up with a percentage that with that nearly 15,000 acres, that it's a little over 8% that has bond release, but there's less than that presently eligible for bond release because that 10-year liability period has not otherwise expired on a lot of the lands that have been reclaimed.
in the areas seeded for 10 years, those aren't released from bond until they prove productivity better than prior to mining for a certain number of years, right?
That's correct for any of those having the agriculture use, which is probably over 95% of that acreage listed there.
The acreage listed there, do you know how many of those acres have been seeded for more than 10 years?
Well, for more than 10 years, I guess if you subtract out the acreage that was for 2013, that would mean that would have been for would have been more than that. So some of these lands probably have been reclaimed for at some of the mines. I guess it's probably more than 20 years, and sometimes it's acreage that's dissected by a haul road, or there's still a pond nearby or whatever that it would probably be a smaller, irregular-shaped parcel. Some of the companies have said that they generally don't look at going after bond release to go through everything that's required for collecting data until they get they try to get at least an entire quarter section. Once you do that, a lot of these areas, the companies haven't pursued for that reason. But they certainly could take smaller areas, but again, the bond release requirements, it's not just the data collection, but it's a matter of coming up with legal descriptions and pulling out all the histories for the areas that these bond release packages take a lot of work too.
So for these areas, these agricultural lands, for example, that you mentioned maybe have been reclaimed for 20 years, aside from the other administrative issues you mentioned, they can't be released from bond because they haven't proven productivity yet. Is that right?
Well, that's correct.
How much longer could they go before they need to improve productivity to get final bond release?
Well, that's up to the mining companies. There is no requirement in state or federal law that says that gives a time frame when mining companies have to submit bond release.
So that could be under bond for another 40 years.
It's possibly, and some of these areas, reclaimed areas, are right adjacent to a haul road, particularly if there's other stockpiles for that haul road, that some of these lands could remain under bond for a long period of time.
And when they get the land seeded for a period of 10 years, is a part of their bond released at that point?
They can request that bond be released, but that has to go through the bond release process, which includes a public notice and meeting other informational requirements. So,
has that happened with any of these mines?
The amount of partial bond release we have is pretty minimal. There's one permit area up at Falkirk where they've went through the phase one and two release, and the third phase is for it's considered vegetation establishment and basically stability that the like sedimentation ponds are no longer needed, that the land is stable and not erosive.
So are you saying that the vast majority of the lands that have reached third stage reclamation still are fully bonded?
That is correct.
Okay. And if a mine is unable to prove productivity on a piece of land, they could simply keep that under bond for the next 60 years if they wanted.
Conceivable, the way the law is written, that is the case.
And no more questions right now.
Mr. Biella?
Yes, Your Honor. Jim, looking at PSC 8, let's, earlier in the testimony, there was a statement made that the Freedom Mine had only released 5.6% of their land, but that's not really an accurate statement, is it? Because that is not the land that's been ceded for at least 10 years and available for bond release. Is that correct?
No, is that the, I guess, the total for the Freedom Mine, what we have listed there is, what, 2,746 acres, and when you look at the total what is disturbed, it represents probably about, well, more than 10%, but when you look at what would be eligible for release, it's probably closer to 40-45%.
46, I believe it is.
Okay.
That's a more accurate reflection of what's really going on, isn't it? Of what's eligible for bond release. You can't compare it to the disturbed lands, which are in various stages of mining or whatever. You have to look at what's eligible versus what has to get a real accurate statement. Wouldn't that be correct?
I think that would be more accurate in reflecting where reclamation is at with regard for what's eligible for release. In fact, oftentimes we see figures that are based on the total permitted area, as was kind of mentioned earlier, I guess, for the Freedom Mine. But when you looked at total permitted acreage, oftentimes less than half of that's been actually disturbed by mining. So that is not a good representation of the status of bond release, one, particularly when you use the total permitted acreage.
Well, that's the point you make on Exhibit 7, isn't it? You have the note. Less than one half of the acreage currently under permit has been disturbed by mining as of October 1, 2014. That's your
yes.
point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my point because of the way some of this information has been used in the past or statements were made where it implies that very little, if any, bond release has occurred. So,
just a few more questions. Now, the Reclamation Division standards for evaluation of revegetation and success. It's our Exhibit 4, I believe. It goes on recommended procedures for pre- and post-mining vegetation assessments. That was approved by the Federal Office of Surface Mining. Is that correct?
Yes, we initially submitted that to OSM back in 1988. Then we've had three revisions since then, as submitted to OSM as program amendments that have been approved. But back here around 10 years ago that OSM revised its rules, now that we can make changes without having to have them approve that as a formal program amendment. But that has been approved. The document that's in place right now had OSM approval, and that last change was, what you said, I believe it was 2003 or around that time.
Okay. Has the Public Service Commission and the Office of Federal Surface Office of Surface Mining issued excellence in surface coal mining and reclamation awards to the North American Coal Corporation mines in North Dakota?
Yes, they have.
Number 11. Okay, showing you what has been marked as Exhibit Kyrie Creek number 11. Is this the OSM's 2013 evaluation of the North Dakota Public Service Commission?
Yes, it is for our co-regulatory program.
And is this available on the Public Service Commission's website?
I'm not sure. If it's not, it should be. I know it's available on the OSM website.
Would you turn to page 15, please?
Okay.
Can you read the first three sentences? Of the conclusion, excuse me.
Okay. Based on the topics evaluated this year, North Dakota has an effective program with no issues that need corrective action. NDPSC actively pursues public participation and outreach efforts. NDPSC employees demonstrate an appropriate level of technical expertise and take advantage of OSM and other training opportunities.
Could you read the last sentence, please?
The state conducts the appropriate number of inspections, and those inspections are thorough and complete.
I would offer exhibit number 11.
Mr. Broughton?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No objection.
Coyote Creek, exhibit number 11 is admitted.
Showing you what is marked exhibit number 12. Is this the OSM's 2014 evaluation of the North Dakota Public Service Commission?
Yes, it is the evaluation report, again, for our co-regulatory program.
Is this available on OSM's website?
I'm assuming it is. I guess I haven't went out and looked for it myself, but I'm assuming that it is. They're generally pretty good about posting it as soon as they send them to the states, so.
We'd offer exhibit number 12.
Mr. Broughton?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No objection.
Coyote Creek, exhibit number 12 is admitted.
Please turn to page 31. The conclusion. Could you read the first three sentences, please?
Based on the topics evaluated this year, North Dakota has an effective program with no issues that need corrective action. NDPSC actively pursues public participation and outreach efforts. NDPSC employees demonstrate appropriate level of technical expertise and take advantage of OSM, RE, and other training opportunities.
And then could you skip down? I think it's two sentences. Starts with the words, reclamation is occurring, and read the rest of the paragraph.
Yes. Reclamation is occurring as contemporaneously as possible. NDPSC does an appropriate job of collecting and tracking the data necessary to accurately track and assess reclamation success, as well as the contemporaneous nature of that reclamation. Customer service efforts have been demonstrated to be appropriate and scientifically sound. The state conducts the appropriate number of inspections, and those inspections are thorough and complete.
So would these evaluations indicate that the Federal Office of Service Mining believes the Public Service Commission is doing a good job in enforcing the law and seeing to it that reclamation of mine lands is being successfully completed?
Yes, I believe it does.
I have no further questions.
Commissioner Chrisman?
In your calculations on the bond releases of the lands that have been ceded for 10 years but have not received bond release, did I understand you correctly that a good part of those are not bond released because they're closely associated with haul roads or water ponds or shops or things like that?
I would say a considerable part of that acreage. I don't have a accurate percentage of that, but just the way mines are laid out and the mining generally progresses away from the facilities, so you do have the roads and that that'll continue to serve active mining that go through reclaimed areas.
Are there significant amounts of that acreage where the mine has requested bond release? Not specifically this mine, but you can point out specifically, I guess, if you want, but or either North American or mines in general, where they have sought bond release, but their work, their reclamation work, wasn't sufficient for the PSC to grant the bond release.
No, as far as the denial of bond releases, I think there might have been a couple times where some tracks have been deleted for one reason or the other, but I don't recall where an entire bond release application has been denied because standards were not met. And presently, with regard to what's pending, we do have three bond release applications pending now. Two of those are for the Gascoigne mine, and the other one is for BNI's Center mine.
But there's not large amounts of acreage that are being denied based on the productivity.
No, no, there's not. In fact, I don't recall a bond release ever being denied. There may have been tracks that were removed, then later on they've come back and reapplied for that acreage and have gotten bond release. There's been a couple of situations where they've had data and they thought it met the required standards. Then during our review, we found out there was some problems with that data. Then a track may have been withdrawn from that release and resubmitted. I think I recall that happening up at BNI's Larson mine that is now completely bond released.
And of the acreage that has received bond release, have you over the years received significant amounts of complaints from the landowners about compaction issues or poor grass coverage or problems that they maybe wish that it hadn't been bonded out?
No issues with regard to compaction. I think we've gotten a couple calls with regard to some of the settling features, or as some call them, sinkholes. But there's only been a few of those. And in fact, I recall a couple landowners. In fact, one at the old Indianhead mine that he was somewhat almost disappointed that there was going to be final bond release, because he said if there's bond release, if there's any problems with it, that there's no longer the requirements for the mining company to go in there and do any corrective action. And that was a track where there had been some settling issues along where there had been in the area of a final high wall. But I don't recall just how long that was under bond following reclamation, but it may have went 12, 15 years after the mining was completed.
So once that is bond released, the mine has no more obligation to come in and fix anything, even though we heard today that apparently they have just recently gone in and fixed something that has been bond released?
Yes. Upon final bond release, the commission's jurisdiction terminates unless it's later proven that the company fraudulently provided data or obtained bond release in some manner that was inappropriate. But in essence, that once final bond release is approved, the commission's oversight and responsibility over that land terminates.
Okay, and my last question, having worked 40 years in an industry where you kind of get beat up for not getting the land bond released quickly enough, and then get beat up if something is inadequate and then the bond is released already and there's no one to fix it, do you think 10 years is about the right time frame? And I realize we're operating under federal law and we can't change it as a commission anyway, but if you had your choice, would we push these through more quickly and release the bond and get the land back out into private ownership? Or do you should it be longer, or do you think that we have about the right time frame under federal law?
I think we have about the right time. I guess there could be some arguments made, you know, to reduce that time period, and others to extend it. But overall, I think that is a reasonable time frame that applies to most areas in the Western United States. So,
no other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Jim. How active are you in national, regional mining and reclamation circles?
The state belongs to the Interstate Mining Compact Commission, and I generally attend at least their annual meeting, and they do have a fall meeting as well, and either myself or Dean will generally attend that. Then also that there's an annual OSM Western States meeting. That's a OSM schedule those for each of the three regions they have, where topics of more of a regional interest can be discussed. I'm also a member, haven't been very active for the last, I guess, several years in the American Society of Mining and Reclamation, but that is a professional group that's been around for, I think, well over 30 years.
Okay. And how about staff? How much do you encourage our staff to go out and get continuing education and be up to speed on the latest concerns and topics and standards for mining and reclamation? Are there requirements for staff to do that?
There's no specific requirements, but the OSM does offer a comprehensive training program, and the staff attend that. Particularly newer staff will generally attend several of those within the first couple of years. It provides some good understanding of different aspects of the mining reclamation requirements, but also gives them the opportunity to interact with some of the people in other states and with OSM that work in the same technical areas and have that interaction. We usually have at least one person attend the American Society of Mining and Reclamation, their annual conference. I hear the last few years, Guy Welch has been attending most of those. Here a few years ago, it was held in Laramie, Wyoming, I think, where we had four staff attend that.
And how do these folks share the information that they learn amongst each other on our staff?
I guess through our weekly staff meetings, I guess when people attend training, there's some discussion there. But a lot of it's just with the interaction day-to-day as they're working together on some of these applications. Everybody's located in the same general area, and there's a lot of back and forth discussion, and other discussion comes up as we review and prepare deficiency letters on applications that concerns that one person raises. That oftentimes that's bounced off others and discussed as well. So
we heard, you know, from a number of folks that have concerns that the, you know, reclamation isn't proving out on these coal mine lands, that, you know, the standards aren't keeping up with changing ag production practices, and that there's just not enough being done to actively improve standards and practices. Are you seeing any evidence in all your interaction regionally, nationally, with you, your assistant, and staff? Are you seeing any evidence from studies that reclaiming the land is not working out, that we're not able to do this effectively and return it into productivity?
No, I haven't heard any concerns like that. Overall, the reclamation standards that are in place, with some of the discussions, there's been no indications that there's problems With the basic reclamation standards, with the grading, soil respread, revegetation requirements, or reforestation for a lot of states, that not hearing concerns like that.
Okay. What's happening in this period where the areas are seeded, like especially in this seeded areas, resoiled and seeded, and then you know there's this time frame where they're establishing the productivity of the land and trying to meet the standards. What's happening? Describe for me what's happening with the landowner during that time period.